Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters at Home. I'm Owen Wainhouse. On the programme this week, we're joined by Roger Hawkins, co-founder of Hawkins Brown. Russell Brown and Roger Hawkins founded the firm in 1988, having worked together at Rock Townsend. The two partners started the firm with an initial determination, as they saw it, not to get trapped working on smaller residential projects. The strategy paid off. The firm is now one of the 10 largest architecture practices in the UK, according to the AJ 100 list, and continue to work on large-scale projects, including three stations for London's huge Crossrail project. The firm is also working on the Thames Tideway, now one of Britain's biggest infrastructure projects, to modernise the 150-year-old Bazalgette-designed network of underground sewers. When London's original sewer system was developed, it changed the look and character of the city, with the creation of the Chelsea, Victoria and Albert embankments. In a similar way, the Tideway scheme will create new areas of public realm along the foreshore of the River Thames, with Hawkins Brown leading on the design of these new areas of public space. With the Clerk and Well studio closed, I joined Roger down the line from his home, where I started by asking him to take us back to the founding of the practice.
Mid-80s, when Russell Brown and myself were both working at Rock Townsend. The practice at that time was really a handful of people. I think I was about the 15th person in the office at that stage in 1984. David Rock was the external examiner at Sheffield University, where I was completing my part two, and cheekily offered me a job in my interview. So
we hear that a lot, actually, university lecturers picking the cream of the crop of their students and offering them posts.
Well, it was summer 84, and unlike a lot of my colleagues, they all had a sort of summer holiday planned. I had no money whatsoever. So when David offered me the job, I just jumped at it and started work the following Monday, actually. And at the time, mid-80s, in 84, you know, I guess there was a bit of recession. I was in Sheffield. There was really no employment there. You really had no alternative other than going to London at that time. And that's where I met Russell at Rock Townsend. And it was a brilliant practice to work in. You know, David, you know, was really encouraged us, I think, and you know, some of my early projects, I was given quite a lot of responsibility. I remember doing my part three a year later in 85. And by that stage, I'd sort of seen a fairly large, I think it's about 30 or 40 flats, apartments for London Borough of Islington being refurbished. And I'd run the whole project and had a lot of experience. So I really enjoyed it. I think then we got to the late 80s, or let's say 4 years later, Rock Townsend had grown quite a lot. There was about 115 people there at that stage. I think Russ and I were both a bit frustrated that, you know, what we got used to, having a voice and having responsibility and, you know, was being eroded by this new tier of middle management coming in. And, you know, we just felt, I think, frustrated that we could do that ourselves. And, I mean, it was literally getting drunk in the pub one Friday night and saying we were going to leave. And then this was before mobile phones, so you had to sort of call Russell. I called Russell at home on Sunday evening just to make sure it was still the plan. We wasn't just pub talk. And he said, yeah, let's do it. So we just did it. And we hadn't really planned anything. So our first few months of Hawkins Brown was really just trying to work out what we'd done and where we were and how we might get jobs together.
You didn't have clients lined up then when you left, you just took the jump and
yeah, we had in hindsight we're a bit naive, I guess. We had no work, you know, but what we did do was talk to a lot of people who had set up, and it seemed to us that how you set your stall out defined the practice. And so, you know, if we started doing small scale residential work, we would end up doing that for years. So we made a decision not to do that, not to do any small projects, and try and focus on the type of work we'd been doing at Rock Townsend, which I guess had been primarily public-private sector. I'd worked on Tynemouth Railway Station for Rock Townsend, and I guess some of our early work was essentially still ghosting for Rock Townsend. David Rock was very generous at letting us sort of finish off a few things we'd started, and you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a bit more of a boom time, I guess. We were able to pick up one or two projects that perhaps were crumbs from smaller tables, from the tables of larger practices. I remember one of our first jobs in Beak Street in Soho was a collection of half a dozen buildings which architects GMW had failed to get planning permission, and our clients had bought the site on the back of that. These are clients who we hadn't worked for before, but they got to know Russell through some previous work at Rock Townsend, and that became our first project, and it became the HQ for Ridley Scott in Soho. So it was a great project, a curvy roof we did on the building. I remember getting that through planning at the time, was quite contentious in Westminster, and we showed all of these. We'd been that previous October to Paris for Russell's 30th birthday and taken lots of photographs of Parisian rooftops. And so when we went back to Westminster, we were talking about mansard roofs didn't have to be 70 degrees, they could be curved. And so we designed this curved mansard roof in stainless steel, which was one of our first projects.
There's two things, I guess, there. One is perhaps in practices with partnerships, you often get different partners specialising in different things or enjoying different parts of the practice more. Was there ever did one of you lead on one thing more than the other? What was the...
At Rock Townsend, Russell had been the guy who would be... He never knew what he was working on, so one week to the next, because he was just churning out sketch scheme after sketch scheme. Whereas I'd been a bit more strategic, I guess, and helped bring work into Rock Townsend, which I then spent, you know, a year or so working on. So, and I remember when we handed our notice in, Russell, as an associate, was on 3 months' notice, and I was just on 1 month's notice. But I had a project starting on site that no one else really knew about. So we negotiated between us to work 2 months each. And I guess we always had that sort of plan in our mind that, if you like, we toyed with the idea of being HB, as on the pencil, that I was the hard guy and Russell was the soft guy, like in the lead. But we felt that was a bit stereotyping us, and that we often rehearsed, I guess, our roles with different clients, that you know, we might take on different responsibilities and try and share the work. I think what we recognised is we both were good talkers. Back at Rock Townsend, you know, the office had moved to a new space when we were there, which was a long and thin space over a couple of floors. And David Rock decided to put me at the front on the first floor and Russell at the back on the second floor. And I remember asking David why he'd done that. And he said it was because it was the furthest point apart that he could put us. But he did that positively because he thought, he just knew we would be talking to each other and help bring the office together between us. So yeah. I guess that was a skill we had. And I think we probably both recognised that, you know, we need a team around us, because there are plenty of skill, different skills you need to produce a building. And, you know, it was after a few months we managed to employ a couple of people. We set up in June, I seem to remember, and by October we had six people. So we'd managed to grow a sort of small studio to share that responsibility. We had a secretary because my one finger typing wasn't very good. And you know, we had a couple of part two students and a year out student just to help some of the production work that we were doing. But we both assumed roles in the office of design and, you know, working together. We never had a situation where there was a group of Russell projects and a group of Roger projects. We just worked jointly on Hawkins Brown projects. Again, that was always part of our thinking, that the whole was greater than the sum of the parts, if you like, that we would work together on stuff and bring in other people. And I think it's interesting, Owen, you asking about Rock Townsend. I mean, I think one of our frustrations at Rock Townsend was, towards the end, was that we didn't have a voice and we felt we could do better than that. And when we employed young people, we really were very keen to ensure they had a role and had a voice in developing projects. So we always developed this team approach to design. I think we had a fairly flat structure, which you know, I still maintain we have today, frankly. You know, if you come to work, you've got to enjoy yourself. So we want to make sure we create a great environment for people to work in. And I think, you know, we manage by infection rather than dictation, I would argue.
And that, I mean, from the two of you, those kind of first initial hires, the, I think, eighth largest practice in the UK now, the AJ100. So a kind of phenomenal growth. Just kind of always interested in how, I guess, hindsight's one thing, quite easy for people to look back and justify the kind of growth plans and everything else. But was there an overarching plan back then about the sorts of jobs you wanted to pick up and the sort of practice you wanted to be, the kind of the scale of work?
I think I mentioned, didn't I, that we didn't want to take on small domestic projects. We always had this ambition to work on larger projects. We've always had a business plan, and we've always tried to think 5 years ahead if we can, and refresh that every 3 years. We had a business plan every 3 years. So I remember our first business plan was to, and this goes back, if you like, to the late 80s. We were looking at public private partnerships, I guess, at the time, and you know, I guess perhaps fortuitous, but we launched ourselves in 1991, you know, after 3 years. You needed 3 years audited accounts in to get any public sector work, and so we had this strategy of launching ourselves in 1991, targeting education and targeting transport work. And that coincided with New Labour campaigning for better public buildings and looking at investing in new schools, building schools for the future, looking at improving our social infrastructure as well as our rail stations. So, you know, you could see that came out, that thinking came out very much from having this business plan. You know, we were able to get work, you know, on Crossrail. Our interview was on March the 18th, 1992. I remember that date because it's the day my son was born. I remember saying to my wife, you know, when's this baby due? He can't come on the 18th because we've got a really important interview. And of course, that's the day he was born. But luckily, it was in the evening after our interview. Well, he's now 28, which marks how long we've been working on Crossrail.
Yeah.
And wow. And that again stems from that sort of ambition to work on the larger scale work. It was always our thinking that we didn't want to just do small projects. We wanted to work on, you know, larger work. And the same goes for education. You know, before we were even able to tender for work formally, Russell was doing a bit of teaching in Birmingham at what was at the time Birmingham Institute of Art and Design. And just by teaching there, he got to know that the estates team were planning to reclad the building. And, you know, we observed that they were just going to do this with like-for-like curtain walling, which wasn't particularly attractive and didn't really deal with any of the internal circulation issues, which, you know, all of the staff and students were concerned about. So we pitched to the estates department saying we could organise this project for them for the same money, it would be better. We identified that we, you know, for the same budget, they were at the bottom end of the curtain walling market or the top end of the window and wall market. So we redesigned the building as a sort of overclad with an insulated render system and windows rather than curtain walling, reorganised the circulation and won that job, one of our first projects. So that when we were pitching back into the university sector, we had some built work, and there was a guy at University of Southampton called David Chettlebrough, who was head of estates, and he really followed the architectural scene, I guess. He'd just completed the student union with Allies and Morrison, who were a young practice. And then the next project came up, which was a Faculty of Arts building, which we pitched for, I think, in 92. And well, we won that. So, you know, again, we were growing the practice. That was about a £6 or 7 million project at the time. You know, quite a meaty project for us to gain some experience in that sector. Yeah. So I think both of those examples come from, you know, strategic business plan. And every, as I say, every year, every 3 years, we would update the business plan. I remember, you know, towards the late 90s, we had a consultant in giving us advice, and he felt that we were all over the place. We were doing bits of new building, bits of refurbishment. We were working across different sectors. You know, we hadn't really got any focus to what we were doing. And he said, you know, you're going to have to specialise a bit more because you can't be generalists. And we didn't really accept that. But we had a fairly big argument with him, I remember, at the time. Yeah, good humoured. And we came up with this plan that we were going to focus on mixed use, which he bought into because it allowed us to have a strategic plan around how we were going to move forward and market ourselves, allowing us to do different sectors of work, but under that banner of mixed use.
And did that, I'm just kind of wondering where that focus on the business plan came in, really. Was that something that was taught at Sheffield, or was that something you, because you'd not, you know, the only place you could have picked that up from previously was at Rocktown's End. Where did the, because quite an early focus on developing a three-year business plan, there's not many, maybe small practices initially start out quite so quickly thinking about a strategy and bringing in a consultant and thinking about the business strategy. Where did that idea come from, that focus?
I suspect it was partly Sheffield. You know, I remember Sheffield being a really good school and really enjoying my time there. I did both parts one and two there. Russell was at Bristol and Newcastle. I think Bristol closed down when he was in his final year, and he always claims that's how he passed, because they had no mechanism for doing resits because the school was being disbanded, so it was 100% pass rate that 1 year. But going back to Sheffield, you know, there's some interesting practices emerged from Sheffield at a similar time. You know, when I was in third year, Simon Alford and Paul Monaghan joined Sheffield, and so I knew them pretty well at the time because I was back in fifth year when they were in third year. So I spent a couple of years together with Simon and Paul. I remember, again at Sheffield, we had Brian Anson came for a student conference and encouraged all of the years to just break out of their year groups and go and sit all over the studio, sit anywhere, he was suggesting. And I went, moved my desk and sat next to Greg Panoia of Panoia and Prasad. So there's some interesting people emerging. I think they had this strategy of teaching management practice and law, as it's now called, by bringing in people from BDP. So we were taught about BDP management systems while we were still students. I think the other thing, in my case, I did my year out in the States and worked for a very organised practice called VVKR, Vosbeck, Kendrick and Redinger. Bill Vosbeck is just celebrating his 96th birthday at the moment. And he was president of the AIA while I was there. And again, I learned a lot from that, I think. Certainly learned a lot at Rock Townsend. And as I mentioned earlier, David Rock and John Townsend were very supportive of us and shared, I think, a lot of their strategies towards growth and business. So it was always part of the thinking. But I don't think it detracts from design. You know, we were always taught about the importance of design, you know, and David Rock would be talking about our product being design and that we had to really focus on good design. I think at the time, Rock Townsend were one of the top architects. So we've always learnt that too. We've always learnt to, I think, for design to emerge through a very rigorous process of testing and iteration and involving clients in design decisions. I think, you know, going back in the day, we used to talk about our architecture being responsive. You know, we would respond to site, we would respond to user requirements, respond to the planning brief. We would think hard and think rationally and laterally about how design could evolve from or respond from a whole series of inputs. And often I think our solutions for designs become layered because you end up having layers of solutions to suit those different criteria. So we were never trained, either at Sheffield or Rock Townsend or in our early career, to what I call swirl the cape and deliver a design without ever saying where it came from and never allowing a client to challenge it. You know, I think there's that signature architecture, isn't there, of delivering a design as a piece of sculpture and it never changing. Yeah. Well, you know, we don't work like that. You know, I think our design emerges from an understanding of the brief, and I often argue with or debate within the studio that design emerges from the inside, really. We have to understand how buildings are going to function. And, you know, so if you think about that mentality now, our current practice, I think we tend to do well where we have complicated clients who are, let's say, a committee, because you have to sort of reach out and listen and engage with a whole group, different groups of people, to come up with a solution. It's perhaps less appropriate where you've got a figurehead client who just wants to have that one-to-one relationship with his or her architect.
And that, so we talked earlier about the, you know, from the beginning, kind of looking towards some of these bigger projects, and you mentioned kind of Crossrail earlier, which is, you know, certainly at one point was Europe's largest engineering project and taking place, you know, largely unseen in terms of the work that was going on. I guess the other huge project, kind of huge engineering project as well going on in London, is the Thames Tideway. And I think it's interesting, you can just see along the Thames in a few spots a number of cranes and a bit of work going on above ground, but still relatively unseen at the moment. Just tell us a little bit about your work on the Thames Tideway. I think that's interesting as a engineering project that bridges architecture and engineering, but also one of those, you know, super big scale projects.
Yeah, Thames Tideway is a fascinating project. It provides this new super sewer running essentially west to east under London. I mean, I think if you look at, you know, trying to justify why it's needed, if you go back to the great sanitation programme that Bazalgette did in the mid-19th century, it was dealing with London's population of, you know, a couple of million. Now we are approaching 10 million. The sewer system just doesn't work. You know, the Bazalgette drainage was always allowed to overflow at peak times into the Thames, which might happen once or twice a year within a flood, because it essentially combines the surface water drainage with the foul drainage into a single system. And you know, the problem that London has at the moment, or Thames Water has specifically, is that, you know, two or three times a month the system's overflowing, and Thames Water's been fined, I think, a figure of around €20 million virtually every year for discharging raw sewage onto the Normandy beaches. So, you know, I don't think it's the be all and end all. I think we need to look holistically at drainage and deal with sustainable drainage systems in new developments and you know, urban areas around the whole of London. But in addition to that, we need this big sewer system. And you're right to say it's a massive engineering project. These projects tend to take a long time to procure. It goes through a sort of act of parliament to create the sort of rights and the powers to do it. And so in a sense, that's similar to Crossrail, which had the Crossrail Act. Mm-hmm. The Thames Water got powers to build this sewer. And what that came with was a series of outline designs, identifying the engineering route and where it would strike surface. It needs to come to the surface at various points for access and maintenance. But fundamentally, what Bazalgette did was connect the sort of lost rivers of London, which were in culverts, connect it through to the new embankment. And so what we're doing is picking up some of the same lost rivers, and there needs to be, you know, larger scale engineering to sort of pick up these culverts, and you know that defines the location of the various super manholes, if you like, that we're involved with.
And just tell us where those locations are, certainly for the central section that you're working on.
Okay, well, we're working on the central section, and if I start in the city, the most easterly point that we're working on is Blackfriars. Amazing new public space which projects 30 metres out into the river. It's virtually 200 metres long. It's going to create incredible new views of London, because you're going to be able to look from this new terrace westwards towards the Houses of Parliament, or eastwards down towards Tower Bridge. It faces south with incredible sort of views onto the river. We've been working with Nathan Coley, who's the artist. He's devised these tall concrete black concrete stages, which frame these different views, which create different areas for rest and relaxation.
So Blackfriars is one location. The next, moving down to the, which way are we going? West.
Move west towards Westminster. And we have Victoria Embankment in Westminster. I think what's been very interesting with the Tideway project is each of these sites is in a different local authority. So we've been given quite a lot of opportunity, I think, within the city to look at working with them to maximise the views and the routes through the space and develop the landscaping. Whereas the city were very insistent that the design that was previously proposed as part of the works order is retained. So there we have quite a different design. It's a lot more formal. It's using bronze and creating porticos. More of a formal response, I think, to extend the gardens that are there. And then further upriver again into Kensington and Chelsea, where we've been designing a space next to the Royal Hospital. We've been able to design this completely differently because it's sort of part of the river edge, and we've used brick and eroded forms reflecting the alluvial nature of the movement through the river. So what's going to be incredibly interesting when they're all finished is that they're going to be quite different, reflecting the characteristics of that particular site or of the requirements of the local authority, working with different artists on the different sites. But what we've tried to do is find a sort of uniformity, things like the light fittings and the light quality. So perhaps if you go down the river at night time, you'll be able to, when the lights are showing, you'll be able to see a consistency in the light quality. We've used a standard palette of materials in terms of the balustrade. In some areas, it's, for example, back in Westminster, where they require it to be a bronze to match the other metalwork, we were doing that, whereas in other areas it's going to be more of a really dark metal, so that it'll reflect the locality, but the form and shape of the balustrade is going to be consistent across the different sites.
And last time I was down by the Thames, I could see the cranes doing the kind of superstructure work, and I guess that's a thing people will have noticed along the river. But what I guess strikes me is kind of slightly how, I mean, maybe these things just get reported kind of towards completion, but how underreported the project has been, really, given the significance and the kind of vast new public spaces really being created for London, the spaces that will outlast both of us and you know, change London's open spaces quite significantly, really.
I think in the early days of the project, Tideway were very nervous about promoting it too much. They saw it as a big engineering project. It was going to take many years to get delivered. And so a lot of it was, it was done through proper process through the Houses of Parliament, but they didn't really highlight the sort of design opportunity at ground level against the tideway. It was almost about mitigation and, you know, seeking to, you know, put things back as and deal with it environmentally, etc. I think now that it's becoming more in the public realm and the sites, as you say, are very visible, the opportunity to talk about the design is here, actually. And what we're really hoping to do as part of the London Festival of Architecture is charter one of those cruise boats that goes down the river. We've got some video footage which is we can superimpose the new designs so that when you flow down the river in this on this river cruise, you better look out of the windows and see the construction site, and then superimposed on our video will be the new proposed designs. Now, I guess with social distancing, we might not be able to run the full cruise this summer, but we're hoping we can maybe reorganise it for later in the year or even next year. And I don't see why it wouldn't be possible for the images that we're preparing to be made available through the festival website, because they really are going to become amazing spaces.
When's the timescale for completion?
It's still got, you know, another 2 or 3 years of work to be complete. So 2023, I think, is when we're going to be looking at a big opening date. You know, there's tunnelling still going on in the ground, and then there's a lot of work to connect the various lost rivers to the Suir itself. So the engineering is quite incredible that's going on. And, you know, I think the other thing that is going to dramatically affect London is the water quality. What the Tideway tunnel is going to do is to just remove massive amounts of essentially raw sewage which gets deposited into the Thames and clean the water.
And carried out to sea as well, and beaches along the coastline. And in terms of timing, obviously we just mentioned the kind of social distancing there. I guess people have suddenly had this newfound respect for our open spaces, our parks, and our, you know, kind of public realm. Quite fortuitous timing, maybe, in terms of creating these new bigger public spaces as social distancing continues. I guess maybe that just brings us on in the last little bit of time that we've got to how the practice are adapting and coping. Your practice now, it's based in Clerkenwell. Just tell us a little bit about how you're all adapting and working from home, and how our eighth largest practice in the UK changes its ways of working to cope with that.
I think across the whole profession, the whole industry, there's been an amazing transformation to using the technology that allows us to meet remotely, whether that's Zoom or Teams. You know, we have pretty much overnight geared up for 280 staff to work from home. Some people needed a bit more support because they might need furniture taking home. But generally speaking, everyone's been able to manage. We've had to furlough a few people, just about 10%, primarily staff who would have worked front of house, let's say. We are continuing to provide services for really all of our clients at every stage of the project. You know, it's incredible how we're seeing client briefing happening using Teams, how planning committees are and design review panels are using remote technology. You know, we're seeing sites adapting to use social distancing while they're on site. We've been a big advocate of using modern methods of construction, where you can actually create healthy conditions within a factory or a warehouse to assemble components and then use fewer people on site to erect and construct. So designing for manufacturing and assembly on site is something we've been actively promoting for many years. So we're seeing that coming through, and some of our sites where we're working with Langer Rourke in Oxford, a new biochemistry building, or with Mace in Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park, Plot 6. These sites are carrying on working safely. Contractors are used to working in safe environments. We have offices now in Manchester. That's Studio North in Manchester. We have Studio Scotland in Edinburgh. We have a handful of people in Los Angeles. And actually what this new way of working has taught everyone is that they're much closer than we perhaps thought they were. We can continue to work and engage with them remotely. We're sharing sketch pads through plugins to Teams, so we can have virtual design review and design team meetings where we're all sketching on the same virtual drawing. We're using our kitchen tables to make models, and using the phone camera to sort of provide walkthroughs of those models. Quite incredible, the sort of robustness, if you like, across the whole industry, and that's what we're continuing to do.
And do you think that will change then? You talked about the expansion, certainly Manchester, Scotland, and the States. Will that, I guess we're trying to think about positives in what will change after lockdown, will that change the way that the studios, I mean, work together and improve, you know, perhaps that collaborative approach between the different studios? Is that one of the positive outcomes, maybe, do you think? Are there any other positives, maybe? Always trying to think about the positives.
There's a lot of discussion at the moment on the news about how we might ease the lockdown and what a new normal might be. I think it's going to have long-term repercussions on how we all work together. We're talking about slowly getting people back into our studio, but perhaps at considerably reduced occupancy, so that that means that we are going to perhaps encourage a lot more working from home and stagger the times when people are in the studio. I think it allows, you know, this sort of dialogue between our different studios, whether it's Edinburgh or Manchester or London, and we have two spaces in London, so just getting everyone working together virtually, I think, has been beneficial. So yeah. What will be interesting is how the sort of easing of lockdown allows us to merge, you know, a bit of getting together, a bit of working in a studio, overlapping with virtual connection. So we've already been talking at Hawkins Brown about how we're going to adapt our meeting rooms so that they, all of them, can have digital interaction through our screen, so that the norm will be, I think, now to have a meeting where a few people might be in the studio, and, you know, two-thirds of the meeting are attending virtually. I think it affects our design processes. You know, the sort of huddle around the kitchen table is going to be a more of an open huddle. So it allows people with different skills, whether they're presentation skills or technical construction skills, to all collaborate together across different neighbourhoods and different locations. We use the word studio as a sort of collective of a whole group of people. So I think we'll be running virtual studio to develop design.
And then I guess just finally, I'm just kind of interested in how people are rethinking their own living environments and their own, you know, how are you adapting to working from home? Is everything, you're not in a building you've designed yourself, presumably, are you? What's your setting?
Well, I've lived in the same house for 30 years now, and so I guess it's evolved, and I've done the odd little project here. I'm sitting at a breakfast bar, which connects the kitchen to what was historically the dining room, and so I've got the benefit of being able to use my dining table to spread stuff out, and the kitchen to go and make myself a cup of tea. So it, you know, it's a perfectly fine environment to work in. I do miss actually not just being able to just bump into people. So that needs a different attitude to actually, you know, hit the send button on a Microsoft Teams meeting invite, or just reflect about, you know, decisions or projects I'm working on and who else I need to involve in that, to try and remember that I'm not alone, because otherwise it could be, I think, interesting just being here on my own. I think that's, you know, that it's interesting though, isn't it? I mean, that's my personal circumstances. I think what we're finding is that sort of younger people who might be in a shared house, or people who've got younger families, let's say, actually having a bit of distance between them rather than having to look after their kids, have got different issues to deal with. So, whether we prioritise those people in terms of bringing a few people back into the studio, you know, I think we have to really listen very carefully to our staff and people they're working with, to make sure people they're working and living with, to make sure that we can deal with everyone's circumstances.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters at Home. On the programme this week was Roger Hawkins. You can find out more about Roger and his work at architecturemasters.org, where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.